What brings you, first of all, here to North Dakota? It's not your first time into the region.
Yes, so my main is organizing the farm tours and all sorts of business events for the farmers from Ukraine, because in Ukraine we do not have any support like you have here, the extension. Therefore, farmers are looking for technologies worldwide, and my task is to help them locate the ones that they can use. So I have been bringing groups to Midwest and to North Dakota for at least about 10 times already. And that's not the only states or the only places that we've traveled. This is my 40th time to the United States of America. However, this time with a totally different mission, which is bringing the awareness of the situation that is going on in rural Ukraine, the actual damages due to the war, and, of course, trying to accumulate some donations to help the people in most need in those areas be able to rebuild their roofs over their heads and repurchase these farm animals that were destroyed due to the missile attacks or just simply due to the terror that the Russian soldiers were doing in the villages that when they were coming towards Kyiv.
So it's been 4 months since the Russian invasion. Can you paint the picture of really what is the situation for Russian or for Ukrainian agriculture today?
So first of all, Russians, when they started the war, they were targeting with their missiles the military airports. Then there were the military bases and the hospitals. The hospitals, this is their program of running the war that they have tested in Syria. That's meant not to be, for the country that they are trying to invade, not to be able to fix their soldiers in the clinics. After that, they destroyed their fuel storages, and now they shifted towards the agriculture. They use this leverage or this fact that Ukraine cannot export as their thing to blackmail the world. And they do everything they can to limit the alternative ways to export Ukrainian commodities. And it is known, we have from 20 million metric tons to 35, according to different estimates, because we do not know what's going on in the occupied areas in the south. So those commodities are for export. They're expected by the countries in the Middle East and in the countries of Africa, where people do not have alternative source of food. However, the Russian Federation, they are trying to limit any way for us to export. So they've blocked all the ports. They have destroyed a number of the terminals, the major terminals. Like, for example, 10 days ago, the second largest in Ukraine, in the port of Mykolaiv. This is the port on the Dnieper River, which they still do not control, one of not many that they do not control. So they have this attitude, if we cannot take over within a couple of days, then we just destroy. And this is the official order. In terms of the actual ground, so there is a lot to talk here. First of all, we need to understand that when the military equipment is coming through the field, the soil health is suffering most of all. The explosions are destroying the landscapes. I've just read the update from the ecological inspection, and they say that all those chemicals that are coming out and settling on the fields, including the sulfur and others, they very badly influence the soil and the microbiology of the soil, not to speak about the actual the mixing of the soil layers and just destroying the landscape. There are too many of those potholes or huge creeks from the explosions in the fields. And when they were entering the villages where there are the farmers or the farms of the private farmers, that would be the mid-sized farmers in Ukraine, they would take the most expensive stuff or destroy it, either of those two. First of all, they were targeting to take the computers, the monitors in the John Deere equipment. That would be the second most precious prize they can get, so to say, after gold. So they would steal the golden stuff, and then they would target these monitors. I don't know how come they didn't realize that those monitors can be shut down distantly. Then they were taking the actual equipment, and there are a lot of facts when they came into the dealerships. For example, in Melitopol, that was in the later March, they've taken a number of equipment, new units of equipment of John Deere, and it was located by the John Deere system later in Chechnya. Again, those tractors and one combine, it seems to me, were shut down distantly. If they were not able to take something, like, for example, the elevators, they would simply destroy the system of automatization at the elevator, the most expensive part, the computers, the sensors, the automatics. The same they did with the combines that they didn't take with them. They simply destroyed the panel where all the electronics is, and it would take thousands of dollars and months to fix it. So their attitude is, we do whatever we can in order to take it away. If not, then we just destroy it so that you, Ukrainians, will not be able to use it. This is their attitude, and it was proven by a lot of intercepted phone calls between the soldiers and their relatives in Russia, because when they come to Ukraine, their conversations from the cell phones are coming through the Ukrainian cell mobile operators. And, of course, they record them. There are hundreds to thousands of those phone calls that they share what they did in Ukraine.
You talked about the port situation. I know Turkey and the UN have tried to find that humanitarian route to move things out of the port. Is that possible, even with the mines and everything else that are in the port waters?
First of all, yes, it is theoretically possible, but it is not something that Ukraine would be looking for or would allow, because Turkey is trying to bargain 25% discount for the crops if they participate in creating this corridor, if they convince Russia. Russia on their side say, we have nothing to do with the blockage of the ports. It's Ukrainians who block them. We can allow the ship come in and secure the international ship coming to the ports. However, knowing how fake is their promise or how unreliable is their word, our military, and that's official information, they say that you need to understand, once we open the corridor to the port of Odessa, for example, there would be coming the cargo ships through this corridor toward the port. It would be free from any drifting mines or anything like that, but in between those ships, Russian military ships can get come in, and we will not be able even to shoot them or to protect from them, because they will be in between the cargo ships, international ones. And that's what Russians did multiple times. For example, they would bring hundreds of civilians to their bases, where the military base and where their soldiers were staying, just in order to protect them. There is this meme on internet that Russian soldier takes the cradle with the kid in front of him and goes with the gun towards Ukrainian soldier. But Ukrainian soldier on the opposite side takes his kid behind and goes with the gun towards the Russian soldier. This is the way they do war. No principles, no following the Geneva Conventions or something like that. Therefore, for Ukraine, it is extremely dangerous to allow ports to open, because we will not only lose the territory, but judging from the things that happened in Bucha, Irpin, and so on, the cities, the towns that don't want to give off, people get just massive massacres done in those areas. And Odessa is definitely not supportive of joining Odessa Oblast. I mean, the whole region, not just the city, is against supporting the idea of joining the Russia.
When I look at agriculture in Ukraine, the breadbasket, so to speak, but many of the crops we grow here, the wheat, barley, sugar beet, sunflowers, tell us where you are in the cropping season, and are we able to plant a crop? Will we be able to harvest a crop?
We are very similar. If you take the latitude a little bit, Ukraine is a little bit to the north from North Dakota. However, the climate is milder if we speak about winters. Other than that, the timing, the length of the seasons are similar, the soil is similar, maybe the landscape would be more hilly, But what we have, what we lack, is the rainfall. You have very good rainfall. In Ukraine, farmers, for example, in the southern areas, the areas where they grow mainly winter crops for the reason of lack of moisture, they get about a little less than, at times, even 8 inches of annual rain. And with 10 inches, they succeed to grow corn. So this year, they planted, of course, all the winter crops were planted before the war. Some of them cannot be harvested. That's the reason. The reasons are the mines and the occupied territories, which are just unreachable for the farmers. If we speak about the spring crops, they usually make up from 50% of the total acreage of arable lands in Ukraine to maybe 60, or let's say 40 to 60, that would be most appropriate. And that depends upon how well did the winter crops do over the winter. This winter they did very well, but the war came. So nobody were replanting those territories under the winter crops. And the territories, the acreage that was supposed to be for the spring crops was planted about 75%. So 25% of the land that was supposed to be for the spring crops is not planted for the same reason. The total acreage in Ukraine, in acres, it is 770 million acres of land that we do for farming, that we farm.
I'm going to bring John into the conversation. John Birch farms in the Hillsborough area. You know Roman through the North Dakota leadership, rural leadership program. Talk to me about what your thoughts are when you know what you've gone through trying to farm this spring and get a crop in, but it's an entirely different story in that part of the world.
It's just, it's hard to put into words. It's literally hard to put into words what you hear these farmers, and then when Roman comes over here and is speaking about what they're going through. So this spring, yeah, we had raindrops and a lot of moisture that we were dealing with that was coming out of the sky, and they have bombs. They're coming out of their sky, and they're trying to plant. And you see the pictures of these farmers that are in tactical gear and that have tanks, literally tanks, in their field to help them and protect them while they're planting. So it like I said, it paints a picture, and it just, I think, humbles all of us in regards of, okay, I'll deal with the moisture.
Yeah, it really tells the story. When you take a look at the shortages that we've been dealing with, some supply chain issues, I'm curious, obviously, in a war situation, what are you doing with fuel? What are you doing with equipment, seed, fuel, crop inputs? What's that situation like, Roman?
Very well said by John, and this was probably the first year when I realized that I didn't pay attention to the precipitation that came over winter in our country and how the winter crops survived. At that moment, I was just focused on other things. So, but thanks God, the winter was okay. Precipitation is moderate, just like normal for Ukraine. However, the inputs, that is a problem. You see, Ukraine has been developing as the business farming country since maybe 2000. Before that, those were the collective farms that, at first, collective farms during the Soviet Union. Since independence, they were state-owned and subsidized. So none of those periods, they were profitable or effective. Since the year 2000, when the actual private owners came to own these farms, they were looking for ways how to make them effective and how to get profit from them. They succeeded doing it very well, and what they've learned, that they need to buy the inputs in the fall and store their commodities until spring. One thing made a good story for them this year. They had about 60 to maybe 80% of all the inputs purchased up front before the war broke out, and they could finish the planting season theoretically with some cutoffs in the technology this year. However, ability to sell the commodities usually brings the profit and brings the cash for the planting season, and they were not able to sell. So with the beginning of the war, what they did, first they took care of their families, took them outside the country or to the Western Oblast. Then they returned and started supporting the army and the local battalions to protect their communities. So they spent all their money that they had on the accounts, and they spent all their crops or commodities that they could in order to supply the army with food and the people in the village or in the area with food. Those would be the meat, all the beans, all the eggs, chicken, and whatever they could use, especially such things as buckwheat. In Ukraine, we grow a lot of buckwheat. It is very good for diet, so they just gave all of that. And by the time they were supposed to go into the fields planting, they understood that they cannot sell the commodities. Therefore, they cannot get the money for planting. And one helping hand was that government came out with these programs for the loans, from the bank loans with no interest and with collateral providing by the government. But there was a problem that a lot of areas were considered to be too risky for the banks to give out the money. So farmers were doing very... The Ukraine has come through a number of crises, and we've learned how to survive. Farmers were making up things, borrowing money, traveling to other oblasts where they can get some fuel or some seeds or some fertilizers, promising to pay back. And there is this farmer who we are trying to help. He lost literally everything, including equipment, all the inputs and the seeds and the commodities. So having a lot of people depending upon him, he decided to go into the field and plant the commodity, the wheat, that was maybe 20% burned. So if you look at these grains of the wheat, there are these dark seeds that were burned due to the attack. But still, he planted it because he needed to get some revenue. He wrote a lot of guarantee letters that he would pay back for the fuel, pay back for the tractor rental, pay back for everything that he needed for the planting from the crop, which he doesn't know if he will be able to harvest and if he will be able to sell. So these are the risks that other people wouldn't even consider planting. And I know farmers like that too. They said, Roman, I farm about 1,000 hectares. I have other businesses. I decided not to go into the field and leave it fallow. I have commodities in the storage. I don't have fuel. I don't have the possibility to sell it. I don't have the equity to do the planting. So the field is left fallow.
As a farmer, John, it's got to be disheartening just to hear what the situation is for these growers.
Yeah, it really is. You know, I talking to my agronomist this morning, and I'm humbled probably more than anything, because he's like, boy, this grasshopper situation. And it's like, yeah, those darn grasshoppers are eating away at my soybeans and everything. And yeah, then I sit here and get an update about, yeah, burned wheat seed.
Yeah.
Burned wheat. And so it's disheartening. And especially when Roman back in 2019, he brought a delegation of farmers. I've met these Ukrainian farmers. And I think highly of them and what they're trying to do and what they're trying to accomplish. And to think of what they're facing now, you know, as just like back in 2019, what they were trying to build and grow into. But now what they're facing and the challenges that they're having is... Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot, to say the least.
Roman, we talked a bit before we got in the studio, but back in history, back in the days of Stalin, there was a time of forced starvation, really, of the Ukrainian people. Do you see that happening again with the current Russian leadership?
Unfortunately, the history is repeating itself for at least the third time right now, and that's from the most vivid catastrophes that we had connected with Russia in our history. If we go even a little bit earlier, when the whole Soviet Union was formed, there were this attitude toward the private farmers that they were like evil or villains in Ukraine. So the Labor Party, the Communist Party, considered the private business as the evil. And they have taken all the property from the successful at that moment farmers in Ukraine who were feeding not only Ukraine but all Europe. and they were creating the flow of the cash into the country. But instead, they were either shot to death or taken to the North Siberia, and all their property was given towards the collective farms. What is the collective farm? This is when the property belongs to everyone in an equal sense, but it means that it belongs to no one and no one cares. So as a result, there was a huge drop in the effectiveness of those farms. And the Communist Party, they said, okay, there are some industries that must be subsidized because they cannot be profitable. How come if they had been profitable before and now we see in the whole world? Yes, in some countries it is subsidized, but even in the countries where agriculture is not subsidized, this is the business and it brings profits. It creates jobs, it pays taxes. So until the independence of Ukraine, those collective farms were just sucking out the money from other industries. The second situation in the history, or like catastrophe or attack to the Ukrainian agricultural industry by Russia, was also during the Soviet times by Stalin, this famine or starvation in 1932-33. And no one can even imagine how difficult it was at that times when there were no supermarkets, no alternative ways. They couldn't leave their villages. They were tied to the place where they lived. And they would see that those people who belonged in the cities to the party, they had food, but their food, the food of the village citizens, grown by them, and stored in the basements before the winter, was taken away from them till the last grain, till the last egg. So everything was taken away from families. And the winter was coming. Of course, there wouldn't be any alternative food, finding a way to find a mushroom in the forest. A lot of people died over the winter. In the springtime and the early summer, when the winter crops at the collective farms fields were ripening, people, of course, those who survived, they were taking the actual grain to cook something for them, at least this soup from this grain without meat or anything else. But Communist Party came up with the law that would allow anyone who sees a peasant, a farmer, stealing 5 heads of wheat in the field to kill him or her right there without any court or sue or anything. So it was a life sentence, sentence to death right there for 5 heads of wheat. Ukrainians still survived through that. And we revived, and like I said, in the year 2000, Ukrainian government gave off all the collective farms which were unprofitable, which were subsidized at that time by Ukrainian government, independent Ukrainian government. They gave those farms off to the people in the community who were able to buy them for minimum money. For example, can you imagine buying a 1,000 hectares farm for $5,000? Of course, they had huge debts. Of course, there was no effectiveness. The cows were thin. They wouldn't milk. There were too many employees who were just alcoholics or stealing stuff from the collective farm, because that was the style of life during the Soviet Union. And also a very interesting fact that I just found out from my farmers, until maybe 2007, the local administration in Ukraine would tell the farmer, so the farmers purchased the farms in 2000. For over 7 years, they were told where to buy the seeds, where to buy the inputs, the fertilizer. So if they did it otherwise, you will be having additional checks of the inspections of the governmental institutions that would lead to you losing the business. We've come through that, and now agricultural industry is one of the most supportive to the total governmental economy, economy of the country, for you to understand, 40% of the income from the export, and we have a lot of natural deposits of coal and iron and so on. All of those are exported. So 40% is agricultural import, or sorry, export, agricultural commodities.
So I don't know if you can speak to it, but for Putin, what's the end result here? What's his end game? What is he trying to achieve in what we're seeing here in this invasion?
I have no doubts that his end result is genocide of Ukrainians. He wants the nation of Ukrainians to disappear, and he doesn't care what cost it may come to for him, for his country, but he has this personal, subjective hatred towards Ukrainians. Why? That's discussable, but I think just because we are too successful, so close to his empire. And he still lives in this 16th, 17th century, thinking that empire is the best way to run the country, the best way for the people and for himself. Of course, this is something that cannot be allowed in the 21st century, because conquering your neighbors when there is the legislation that should be working, when there is democracy, when there is when there are human rights, that's unacceptable. And I'm sure that Western countries, no countries in the West would want the outcome of them winning and bringing to the world stage this precedent of the terror, of the force overruling the law and the human rights.
Roman, for the farmers in Ukraine, what do they need today? Obviously, their security is first and foremost, but to stay in the business, the farming, are there things that we can do to help?
First of all, we should be understanding that there are three types of farmers. The first ones, the biggest ones, are the corporations. They have the money. They can get the loan from the international banks. They will survive for sure, and thanks to them, a lot of people still have jobs. There are private farmers who make up about 50% of the land. Those private farmers are very similar to the farmers here in the United States, because actually they have been learning from the United States. So these people, they can also survive by themselves. They have some alternative things to sell in order to get their money for the season. They have storages in most cases. They can sell something and still return to the profitable life a little later. But there is this stratum of society which are actually literally left under the open sky. And yes, lucky that they are alive. Right now, most of them are in the shelters, temporarily shelters. However, these people, they need to return somewhere. And they have been farming in those villages quite heavily in their small limited plots of land. For you to understand, 56% of the population owns farmland in Ukraine. So these people, they farm about 30% of these 70 million acres of land. And they produce huge amounts of their animal produce. For example, the eggs, the milk comes into the total volume as 60% from what they produce. The same with potatoes. 90% of total volume produced of potatoes comes from these small farmers. But they do not have any alternative real estate to stay in. They do not have any ability to get the loans from the banks to rebuild. And they were the first to be attacked because the soldiers, the army was coming through the villages, through their households. So for you to understand, in the villages that were further from the line of the war, every 10th household was severely damaged. However, in the villages where the active war was going on, these villages were torn down to the basement, all the civils, so civil homes, all the business buildings. For example, there is, everyone can find the statistics online, there was a third-party estimation of the damages done to the village north from Kyiv named Moschun. This village is a very, it is the standard village in Ukraine. It had a lot of people living there producing, and all of their houses were torn down by aviation, artillery, and bombs. So they just destroyed it to zero. The costs to rebuild it were evaluated as $33 million just to the houses, not to speak about the business or administrative buildings or the infrastructure, just the houses. And these people, they live either in the basement or in a tent right now or in the truck, like cars, or in those temporarily shelters. It is summer, they can survive. But what do they do in the wintertime? Where do they return? All the programs are coming towards the infrastructure, military, and cities. I mean, international projects of programs of support. These people are put last in line to be helped. Therefore, we have put our main mission here with the project named World to Rebuild Rural Ukraine to help these people return to their homes. We are not providing them with the upgrades or with some fancy stuff. Our mission is to raise the funds. First of all, raise the awareness of them being hurt, and secondly, raise the funds in order to help them rebuild the walls and the roof over their head, help them repurchase these smallest pieces of equipment that got burned or destroyed by Russians, for them to be able to go into the fields and at least grow some crop for their families to be fed in the wintertime. Because this year, every Ukrainian understands that he or she needs to secure his food supply by planting stuff in even at the lawns or in their gardens. So people are planting a lot of commodities wherever they can, just to secure their family's food supply. So that is crucial for Ukraine. And we are looking for any support, a penny per bushel donation from the farmers worldwide, or the actual donation towards the reconstruction of these houses. And in order to inform people about what is going on in those rural areas and in industry in general, we run this bi-weekly or every second week event at 8 a.m. according to Chicago time on Fridays, every second Friday. We talk and we show those people, we come visit their households, we help connect them with the other world so that the world knows about their problems and helps in any way. So this is our mission and why we are here right now.
So how can folks participate in this, these biweekly calls that you have, and how can they contribute to your relief effort?
So I would be grateful if the audience joined their website www.wrru.org. This is the acronym for World to Rebuild Rural Ukraine.org. And there is all the information about, first of all, the direct donations. There is the button there. There is contact information if they have any questions to me directly. And there is also the page, Life, which speaks about all our bi-weeklies that we had and that we will have. There is a possibility to join via Zoom to ask questions or YouTube. So all the information is at that website, www.wrru.org.
John, when I think of the North Dakota agriculture, when there's been a natural disaster, it might be fires in Kansas or a drought in western North Dakota, people step up to the plate. What are you hearing from folks during your travels with the Roman this week?
Yeah, that's exactly it, Don. Is like you said, these different natural disasters that we go through western North Dakota, and even, you know, let's talk about the spring and sandbagging. So we know how to help, you know, those neighbors next to us. And so, like I've been telling a lot of people, the neighbor just looks a little bit different because it's across a pond now, a large pond. But I think a lot of times it is, for us, a lot of people want to help out. It's that trust factor, and that trust factor gives us a little bit of pause and making sure that any donations that are made, that it goes into the right hands and everything. And that's definitely why why I'm here and helping Roman, because I've known Roman. I've built up that trust factor for a while now in him and I's relationship. So what he's doing and what his mission is, it's like I want to spread the message as much as possible that I support it. Our team at Birch Farms has definitely said we will support the penny per bushel for our future crop here in 2022. And so we will be pledging that. We also have something that we've been putting together for a while now in regards to Birch Farms. We've always been looking for a way to outreach people in the larger cities, but even people in the smaller cities. And so we have an event going on at Birch Farms this August 10th called Movie at the Farm. And so we are inviting everybody to come out, 1 to 100. We're going to have all the equipment out on display. You can climb up and you can see all the different equipment. But at the same time, we're going to, again, raise awareness of Roman's project and what's going on in rural Ukraine. And all the proceeds for that night will go towards the Rural Rebuild Ukraine project. So again, I think it's, for me, it's the smallest way. And then, you know, Roman has been so appreciative of the help, but I keep on saying, I just feel it's the very littlest that we could possibly do. So I'm grateful to be here with him and to spread the message. And if anybody wants to reach out to me personally in regards to the relationship or in regards to where the fund's going and more of that information, I'm happy to talk to anybody about that.
Well, Roman, as we look at the clock, I certainly just appreciate the conversation. We know that this is a long recovery process. Once this we move past the current war situation, how confident are you in the future? How optimistic are you for the Ukrainian people?
Yes, I'm asked this question a lot of time. I've been asked it a lot of times already, and I, of course, myself tried to find the answer towards this. We will definitely win. However, the question is how soon and with how many, how high will is going to be the price. I'm sure that they will not return to the northern part of Ukraine because they didn't succeed back then. Now their strength is weaker, but our strength is higher. They understand it. So, for example, the territories over, I mean, to the north from Kyiv, are safe. But how long will it take for them to understand that they are not welcomed in the southern parts of Ukraine and other parts of Ukraine? It depends upon how fast is the military aid that we are getting. Because I know that terrible things are happening in those regions, in the rural areas and in the urban areas. And we must stop that. So once it is, once we have all the military aid in the country, we will do our best within weeks to fight them back and to kick them out from where they do not belong.
No doubt. Well, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you for having me here. And like I said, it is my 40th time to the United States, but this is my warmest time to the United States. Before, it was all about business. Now it's all about the compassion. And thank you, John. Thank you, everyone who takes part and who listens. This is very important. And may God return this aid that you are sending towards Ukraine to you and your families in multiplied times.